Welcome to those arriving today. And welcome back to the Dharma Talk. Supposedly, Chan Master Lung Ya said, those who in past lives were not enlightened will now be enlightened. In this life, meaning this life, meaning right now, save the body, liberate, free the body, which is the fruit of many lives. Many lives of wandering the rounds of birth and death. Now, it's the middle of Sesshin, so let's make sure that we're clear on what we're doing here. The heart of the matter. Many things, of course, are going on in Sesshin, but what's the heart of the matter? What are we really here for? How is it possible to now be enlightened for the benefit of all beings? Of course, this can be put in many ways, this heart of the matter. Our great beneficent original teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha, like to say, nothing whatsoever should be held to, grasped, clung to as me or mine. I propose this is the heart of the matter. This is the liberation from suffering. Plain and simple. Nothing whatsoever should be grasped, held, believed in to be me or mine. One way of talking about grasping is actually, it's not something so much that we do, but it's more like a view that we hold. Liberation, in this case, doesn't arise from some activity, something, some practice that we do. It's more like just simply an understanding. Releasing a misperception by basic observation of how it really is. What are various things that we might grasp as me or mine? Well, like this body is quite at hand here. We might feel like, you might have heard these kind of teachings many times before, and might say, the body's not me, but when it starts getting crunched on the third day of Sesshin, we might then start to identify with this body as me or mine. okay, the body's not really me. That's not really who I am, but it is my body. It is mine. I think it's interesting that the Buddha said, me or mine. Mine is just almost like a derivative of me. You can't have mine without me. But we might feel like, well, there's a lot of things I don't identify with as me, but there's maybe a lot more I identify with as mine. And mine is always based on a me.
You have mine based on a me. When you have mine, when you have me, you have to define a me. You say, oh, this body is me.
Mm-hmm.
But if you say this body is mine, you're acknowledging that there is a me, but you're not deciding what that me is. You say, oh, well, okay, maybe the body isn't me. I don't know what me is, but it's there somewhere. It's something. I don't know, but it's something. It's got to be something. And this body and everything that I have belongs to it.
Yeah, like that. But I think it's that kind of vagueness around what it is, I think is also the case when we say, it's me. It might seem a little more specific, but when we start to look for, oh yeah, it's me, and what is that me that it is? We have the same issue of like, well, what is that actually? We can't quite, it's a little bit vague because, naturally it's vague because we can't find that one, the me that we assume we are, or the me that's the possessor, the owner of everything that's mine. Yeah, it's an assumption and that we make is obviously I'm here, but when we start to look for what is that, it starts to get murky. How wonderful that it gets murky, because that's the way it is. There isn't someone there. We might say, but oh, there is. It's just hidden in the murk. Well, we can look deeper. And sometimes the murkiness may be like the kind of comforting murkiness, because it kind of protects us from seeing that there's nothing actually there. Well, it's in there somewhere, so let's just don't worry about it. But I don't propose worrying about it, but I propose clarifying this, deeply investigating. Other things we could take as me or mine are, besides the body, are emotions. I have a really strong feeling right now. I'm really caught up. I'm feeling really upset. We often maybe don't say, that's who I am, but we do say, that's my feeling. I have an anger problem. It's my anger. It's my problem. It's not me, but it's like, it's my anger. It's my sadness. We identify with it, yeah. And another big one is thoughts. We think of this thought of well, I'm in Sesshin now. We might feel like that's a thought that can arise. Here I am on the third day of Sesshin, and again, I think we often don't feel like that thought is me, but we often do think it's my thought. And the thought, I'm in Sesshin right now, it's just arising due to various conditions of body and mind and the universe. But if we identify with it as my thought, we're, I think, in trouble. In trouble in terms of we can't be free. Even the best thought blissful third day of sesshin, I love it. If that's my thought, we're totally bound by it. We're stuck. But any kind of thought, feeling, or body, or anything else can arise freely if we don't identify it as me or mine. One brief version of the heart of the matter, I propose. And, you know, recently we've been talking about mirror awareness, this background, naturally open and present awareness, always the case, always clear and aware, knowing without touching things, knowing without objects, ungraspable like the mirror, just receiving each reflection. And the reflections, the emotions and thoughts don't stick to it. Also, say that's the heart of the matter. Is it clear how those two different sound, very different sounding hearts of the matter are related? Nothing whatsoever should be clung to as me or mine, and just open to appreciate and be this clear, open mirror awareness. Would anybody like to guess what the relationship between those two?
They're all empty.
They're all empty because they're just stories that are empty.
Yep.
That is one relationship. That all the meaning is not in any of these words. But more specifically, these two. How they work together in the realm of practice instructions.
They're all empty. That would be my practice instruction. When something that seems more real, like maybe emotion, more real. When you were telling the story the other evening with that conversation and whatever it is, and strong emotions start to arise.
Yeah.
And the practice there for you was, oh yeah, the mirror, you know. But I think a practice I would try would be, this emotion is empty.
No. Empty of?
Empty of any kind of existence. Just this form is empty, emotion is empty. I'd try that. I don't know if it would necessarily work or not, but.
Empty, sometimes it's said, empty of me and mine.
So, yeah, it's just causes and conditions. Right?
So that's, I think, closely related to say it's empty of, substantial existence, true existence, or what we think it is not exactly the same, but I think closely related to it's empty of being mine. And we talk about the absence of self of the person, which is nothing is me or mine, and the absence of self of things like emotions. So and that's basically the emptiness of emotions and thoughts means like those don't have an abiding self. So it's a little bit different than I don't have an abiding self. But closely related.
For some reason, they seem to be more real. So, I mean, say, okay, well, there's no inherent existence in that body, that's pretty obvious. But emotions all of a sudden, it's like, whoa, that's real.
Yeah. Well, it's more, it comes so strongly. In a way, if we step back and look, it seems like emotions are less real than the body, right? Because they're just a mind thing. And yet, they grip us more often. I mean, I don't know if I should say more, but it depends on the circumstance. Sometimes, if the body is being broken, that's gonna get us more than any emotion about it, maybe.
Yes. Can I throw a bit of a monkey wrench into this?
Sure.
It's a sincere monkey wrench. It's not a provocative one. I'm really grappling with this issue right now. And I haven't studied much Vajrayana, and I know you have maybe a little bit, but there's a thing I read by Trungpa where he talks about emptiness. And he says that the Mahayana approach, it's like the empty, you know, like letting go approach. But he talks about the Vajrayana attitude of actually engaging with. So it is empty, but that there's an engagement, like say with emotion, that's a doorway, is engagement with it, as contrasted with maybe this other aspect of, oh, it's empty, as if, like I know when I'm grappling with something, you know, sitting on the cushion, part of me's going, okay, it's just empty, come on, just let it go. But then sometimes maybe it's helpful to just dive in, not to play patty cake with it, but to not turn away from it and to actually enter. And so I'm just curious about this. It seems like a different approach than what our tradition tends to emphasize.
I don't really hear it as different.
Okay, so
I think form and emptiness are always together. There's no abstract emptiness apart from the whatever it is that's empty. So if it's like an emotion, I'd say to say, okay, here's a strong emotion, just let it go, or, you know, just relax and let it go. Maybe also closely related to seeing its emptiness, but that might be actually a distraction. It could be like, okay, I'm just relaxing, I let it go, but I did that just as a practice tool, as opposed to like, let's really investigate it. And the only way to investigate whether it's empty or not is to get totally into it. Yeah, we have to be right there with it. And the slightest avoidance, I think we can't find its emptiness because we've lost the total intimacy with it. So I think realizing that it's not me or mine, and realizing that it's empty, we have to be right in the very midst of it, without any avoidance, with great curiosity, mm-hmm. and willing to like look deeply, without actually trying to kind of get it away first.
Good. Okay. Mm-hmm. So then, if rather than sitting there going, come on, let go, come on, be a good girl, let go. So that maybe okay. So enter, dive in. Fully experience, but then what's the mind that can help that not become obsession?
I think we have to ask, what is this?
Okay.
You know, that's the investigation.
Okay.
In whatever words we might use, what is this emotion and why is it causing such distress? So I think, you know, to go to its the emptiness of that dharma is helpful, but I think also as a, you know, maybe even precursor, especially around thoughts, emotions, and body and so on that are so close to home, so close to who I think I am, I think this issue of the self, of the person, me and myself, and that emotion's relation to me, I think is it just with strong emotions. Like in that story I told, that didn't come to mind, but I think that might have helped more than the mirror in that case. It's like, okay, who is feeling like really like threatened and assaulted right now? Who is this? And then, oh, you know, there's a natural biological body and mind reaction here, but the me that I feel like is behind it all, that one actually isn't really threatened or assaulted because it's not there. The body and mind experience is receiving strong energy.
So then, what is it? But then, rather than to just use that as an excuse to get into another discursive thing,
yeah,
not to answer, it's almost like just to keep asking as an opening.
Yeah. Well, if you say who is this? Yeah, I don't think we want to. I think with this kind of investigation, we have this great toolkit of all these Dharma teachings about it. But I think to really have the investigation come alive, if we bring out one of those Dharma instructions from our toolkit as a kind of discursive conceptual thing, I think we miss it.
Oh yeah.
We apply it and then we're like, oh yeah, I know there's no self, so yeah, I'm over that. It's like, then I don't think, it's just an intellectual exercise, it doesn't work, but I think to really ask deeply, I know, I have heard that teaching, so that's what gives me the incentive to look, but now who do I really feel is at the bottom of this? Who's the self core that feels wounded or whatever right now? And like, really, who is that? And we don't come up with an answer because there isn't one there. But I think looking in actually, by the very act of looking, sometimes looking and not finding, in a way, that's the strange kind of goal of such a investigation. The goal is to not find ourselves. Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny, but maybe to nuance that a little bit, it'd be like to not find some abiding self. But not just because, well, maybe we haven't looked enough, but more like not find it because we know that actually it can't be found. Kind of like we understand how it can't be.
Useful and necessary.
Both what?
Practices.
Uh-huh. What, both?
Well, I think, you know.
Which practices?
Well, I think, you know, you can just go emptiness.
Oh.
You know? Genuinely. Mm-hmm. Not just, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. You know? That doesn't work.
Yeah.
To follow the path, like Murakami was talking about.
Uh-huh.
Through the investigation. Mm-hmm. Which is where you will eventually...
I think we can, if we just say emptiness and it just evaporates, I think the only way that can be authentic is if we really understand what it means.
Mm-hmm.
So I think,
yeah.
And through study, we can come to understand what it means. So, but yeah. Or another way to maybe, instead of emptiness, if that seems too vague, we could say like, and like not me, or what's happening here is not, it's really not what I think it is. These are other ways of talking about emptiness. And we might be able to really, you know, this is really, I really know from previous infinite numbers of conversations about these things, and this is why we have these conversations again and again. I really understand that things are not what I think they are, and now in the heat of the moment, I can say, this is really not what I think it is, and we actually do know what that means on some level, kind of experientially, and it does just shift it. Yeah.
I think that story that you told the other night about Suzuki Roshi in the city center was a pretty good example of actually seeing emptiness in action.
And staying totally engaged, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, with this person, yeah.
I agree with what Rob just said, but I couldn't help but think that the degree of maturity in your practice is so far beyond me.
That's your idea.
That is my idea.
Whose idea is it?
And the idea came up with, when you were talking about emotion, I see that so much as being both mental and physical because of how it penetrates. How you have a reaction physically, your heart rate spins up. You know, you could start perspiring.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, what if it escalates beyond that and this nutcase becomes more aggressive? I think it becomes more and more difficult to take that mature stance. And that's why using Suzuki as a model in this, you know, really sets a perspective, because that degree of maturity in practice, or that ability to drop the story, is quite remarkable. I think most of us would have more reactive behavior, both maybe physically and mentally, especially mentally, about the worrisomeness of, oh, this person is really off, you know, and I'm being attacked for no real reason, you know. And so it's a real dilemma to me to drop the story.
Well, I think that we can, conventionally speaking, we can talk about sudden and gradual. And, you know, I think conventionally speaking, we can say there's gradual development over time. We can get more proficient, or more, we can maybe remember more easily the Dharma in the middle of difficult situations. But then the sudden, or maybe immediate, is like this heart of the matter, this principle. Once we're really clear that this is the principle, we might not always be able to do it. Like that case was like, I think I was quite aware of like the principle, and I'm like, I know there's a practice right now, but like, it's not working, you know? It's not possible. But I don't think at that time there was any doubt that there was any other approach than this heart of the matter. And I think that's what I would call maybe like the immediate. We can clarify that again and again in the moment, and you know, and be free, really, really free in the moment, immediately, in the non-gradual way. And Sashin's a great time to do that. Like, okay, let's go to the heart of the matter right now, and really release our hold. And really taste perfect freedom. And then our habits are very strong, so then we come back in. And then that's the gradual thing, is like the habits that overcome us again and again. It's like trusting the heart of the matter more and more deeply, and in more and more challenging situations.
This brings up for me a very real way that teaching works in is the Theravada people that I'm working with at the jail. We keep talking about skillful choices, and how if one of these inmates, before having the reactive behavior that's so natural for so many people, especially people that have a hard time controlling emotions or being reactive, that the skill of waiting a moment before they react. It's like a baby step.
Yeah.
It's this, can you pause long enough to not react?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very similar, I guess.
That's a great practice.
Practice.
Yeah, I think we have many practices like that that are, you know, we could kind of say in a way they're not really the heart of the matter, but they're very helpful. And they're helpful even when approaching the heart of the matter. Like, for example, Sashin, the heart of the matter is not actually to sit really still and upright and don't move. And even, I would say, to be concentrated, to stay with the breath, all these things Actually, I don't think they're the heart of the matter, but they're very wonderful, great practices. We need them, but I don't think we need them, because people can realize the heart of the matter in many different ways, but they seem to be very helpful, and that's why we're here today. And Sashin, once again. But I just want to remind us remember this possibility, the kind of immediate possibility of like freedom at any moment around this, you know, simple but maybe subtle point. Because we could talk more about what's this issue of the me, the self, the me that we're talking about. It could be misunderstood. But also, back a while back when I was saying, what's the relationship between these? One way I was thinking of it is the relationship between nothing whatsoever should be clung to as me or mine, and just rest in the bright, non-dual mirror awareness. One relationship is if nothing whatsoever is clung to as me or mine, so there is no me or mine actually here. Mine could be like everything in my experience I usually think of as mine. So if there's not me and mine, then who are we actually? Then who are we? Or what is there? What's left? The mirror. Yeah. It's kind of like nothing whatsoever should be clung to as me or mine is the kind of like is what's seen through and dropped away. And what's left is this non-dual open awareness that we could in a way say is me. That's truly who I am. That's not a self. There's some debate about this point in different schools of Buddhism. Don't like to talk about that mirror because it starts to sound like another me. But
mirror me.
Mirror, mirror on the wall. Who's the me-est? So ones are kind of simple negation, and ones, what's left? What are we then? Truly, we're just this background awareness where there is no clinging to me or mine, and then everything that's reflected in the mirror is like the appearances of my world, and even the appearances of me. If we feel like, no, this really is, there's really a me here, what is that? From the perspective of the mirror, that's just a reflection on the mirror. Or we could, another relationship between the two is you could say, who does this not clinging to me and mine? Who is that who is practicing not clinging to me and mine? Who is it that's dropping off, grasping body and mind? I say the mirror. The mirror is the one that's not clinging to me and mine. In the mirror metaphor, that's what the mirror does. It just receives illusory appearances and doesn't cling to them. So are there other doubts or about this issue of the heart of the matter, or clarifications to make before we go on for another moment, before we possibly could waste another period of zazen?
I think we could also say that sitting still, following the breath, is the heart of the matter.
How so?
Well,
because that's might be the posture that one could take in situations where me comes up so strongly. Just remember that stillness and body and not holding on to thoughts. And
maybe also we could say, since emptiness is itself form, like kind of we were talking with Kathy, you know, there's no dropping off body and mind without a body and mind. So in that way, just the union of the two truths, when there's seeing through to no abiding me or mine, that must take there must be a particular posture at that time. So there must be a particular posture. So you could say, the heart of the matter at that time in the world of form is this particular posture. But as Dogen says, you know, Zazen is not a matter of sitting or lying down. Right? It's like the Zazen I speak of is not practicing meditation. All these instructions, I think when he's talking about the heart of the matter like that, then it's you know, there's this heart that doesn't depend on forms of practice. So that's what I mean by the heart. Of course, the practice in Sesshin and in formal Zazen periods in the Zendo is to we have many, many practical instructions like really do sit upright, really don't move, really let your breath settle, really stay present, really relax. And by no means do I, by implying they're not the heart of the matter, mean to say they're not worthy, or it doesn't matter, let's just do whatever now. But, do you see the difference? Like, the heart of the matter is like, where, you know, what's the pivot of liberation? So, this posture just being this posture, this breath just being this breath, period. You could say that's it. Because there's no self there. There's no additional, it's not my posture and my breath. If we said it like that, maybe we could say that's the heart of the matter. I see as this sort of naturally evolving theme for some reason in the Sesshin. I think I brought the first day this image of the trellis, which is all the practice forms and structures that we have that for the Buddha nature vine to grow on. And so in a way we don't need that, because the Buddha nature vine grows all over, it'll grow wherever it wants to grow. If there's no trellis, it's happy to grow on the ground, in the mud. But at least this Sesshin, I'm kind of feeling like the forms of practice are like this trellis, and they're just to like raise up the Buddha nature flowers into the air to like express them. This Sesshin, I'm kind of feeling like, in general, more and more, I kind of feel like the forms of our practice are more like just art. It's more like just like an art show. And it's like, and I love it. As you probably can tell, I love this particular kind of art show. So I get really into it. I'm really into like all the details, and I'm writing all these notes to the Inos and Tenzos and like, let's do it a little like this, like a little like, I feel like, you know, sort of dance choreographer. But if they were to ask, is that the heart of the matter? These little like form things you're pointing out, I'd say, no, it's not. We're just like playing with the dance. Yeah. But let's, you know, that's the kind of dance that we're in right now. You know, and is it the same as all other dances? Is it the same as all other expressions? In a way, you know, ultimately speaking, yeah, I think so. I think, but it does seem to be, practically speaking, it seems to be like these setups, this particular type of trellis seems to be so conducive to remembering the heart of the matter. When we're quiet and still and don't have to do anything else, that's the best, I find. When I'm like busy doing other things, it's easy to forget the heart.
The activity is just so focused.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So. And I think we talked about presence some. I think this heart of the matter, one of the really, I'll say essential criterion, that maybe the particular posture doesn't necessarily matter. It could be lying down or sitting or walking or standing or eating or talking or silence. But one, I think, essential criterion is presence. Like this pivot of freedom and bondage is never any other time and place. It's always about right now. And this really focusing, like it's really focused on the present moment. Our practice forms, this particular trellis, is keeps bringing us back to the present. And it's, you know, in a way that, well, we had this discussion, I think, yesterday, right? Is just being completely present, is that the heart of the matter? Is that a third version of the same? Well, I feel a little bit on the fence, but for the sake of all-inclusiveness today, I can see it as, yeah, if we're really, really completely present, means like there's no thinking at all about the previous moment or the following moment, then that self, which is actually just an idea anyway, is actually not, I think it's not really, it's not actually there at the end. It's never there, but it's not bothering us. It's not even appearing and knocking at the door and saying, what about me?
Adding commentary.
So, there's another relationship. What's the relationship between this illusion of an independent self and conceptual thought in general? I think they're closely related, yeah? Either that conceptual thought seems to be mine. I think maybe that's the clearest way to talk about the relationship. Usually conceptual thought is related to me. It's kind of like my issues I'm thinking about almost always. Sometimes it's really something abstract, like I'm maybe somewhat regularly, you know, when we're just making the soup and like, maybe a little more pepper or something. The self might not be that involved. It's just doing a task, and it is conceptual. But I think often in sesshin, our thoughts, because we're not doing some task when we're sitting, if we're not thinking about like, oh, this, how is the posture? This shoulder could come down. Okay. Like those are pretty good, you know, just think just about the details of the posture is pretty good, because in a way it's not even our, if we're really just into the details, it's just like moving a body around. It's not really necessarily mine. But I think when we start to get abstract thinking, conceptual thought in Zazen, it usually is kind of like around the self, at least for me. You know, it's like, how am I doing here? What should I do later? How was that earlier? How did I do? And all these, it often revolves around me, and therefore I would say that's, we might not think, oh, this is my thought about me and it's my thought, but I think if there's pain involved, that's a, I think a clue. If it's not, if this thought, if there's the slightest discomfort, dis-ease in our conceptual thought, I propose, then it's always relating to me, a supposed me and my stuff. So that's the time to check the heart of the matter. Yeah. Is we're sitting, I've said this before, I think, but I think it's a wonderful thing to be, to just, you could use Zazen as like, any time I'm not just like totally resting at ease and totally just content and being here, anything other than that means we're projecting a self, and therefore we have an opportunity to investigate. That's one way to look at Zazen and Sesshin. Yeah. It's like if we're just sitting resting at ease and like there don't have a care in the world, then I'm no problem, don't do anything. Just enjoy it. Sometimes it's like that, yeah, in Sesshin. I'd say, yeah, just totally enjoy it. We might say, but what if I get attached to it? Now we're back into the self again. But is it okay to enjoy it? Like the Buddha, you know, when he kind of had that memory of when he was a kid and he was just enjoying sitting under a tree in the shade. And he's like, oh, no, that can't be the way because it's too enjoyable. And he's like, wait a second, no, it's okay. That kind of enjoyment. But anytime, is that a strange thing to say? Anytime we're not like just peacefully enjoying sesshin means we're projecting an illusory me or mine onto things, and then we have the chance, like right there, instead of going like, just get through it, it's gonna pass, I would say, no, don't lose this opportunity, don't wait. I mean, it will pass, but don't lose this opportunity. And just check it out right now. Where's the me and mine that's being clung to? I think maybe one of the Buddha sutras is like, sometimes it's worded as, instead of nothing whatsoever should be clung to as me or mine, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to as me and mine. It's just not worth it. I mean, it's painful. Rather than, I mean, I think if we say, oh, nothing should be, so just stop it, that's usually me trying to inflict some practice on myself, and it's more of the same. So it's not a matter of doing something or not doing something, it's looking really deeply. Who is this one that seems to be running my show from the day I was born, and will probably continue to appear to run the show, and I can let him, as long as I know who he is, that he's just a like puppet. He's just a He's just a mind construction. There haven't been any stories so far, have there?
That you've told
today? Yeah. Some people here like personal stories.
Some people, apparently, yes.
I mean, this is all kind of a personal story in a way, but it's kind of maybe, it's not so like narrative. So,
Do you want one?
Do you want one? Would people like a story or Kinhin? No preference. Wow. Any other preferences? It's okay if you have them, you can confess them.
Once upon a time, there was no preference.
I was just going to say, I was listening to this talk online from the City Center website, and the person who was giving the talk talked about the Dalai Lama coming and visiting Green Gulch in the 80s, sometime, I think, early 80s. And they must have, you know, had him actually doing Shikhen Tozo practice. But afterwards, his comment was, this Shikhen Tozo practice that he did was really hard.
Well, yeah, hard for the Dalai Lama, but, you know, no problem for us.
Very advanced practice.
What is it, how does it go? Mind itself is Buddha. Practice is difficult. Explanation is easy. Not mind, not Buddha. Practice is easy. Explanation is difficult. That's a poem by Dogen. Difficult and easy are actually more conceptual ideas. Because we can sometimes catch that, because in Zazen sometimes we feel like, this is so hard, Sashin is like torturously difficult and challenging. Who could ever even do this? I can't believe I'm still here. And then sometimes it's like, it's so easy. There's nothing to it at all. Because it includes everything. Yes.
I'm just curious. Do you have the intention of a theme for your talks that I missed the first one? Or are you just sort of like being kind of like, hey, let's see what's up today?
It's a little bit like, hey, let's see what's up today. Which is a little unusual for me.
Yeah, it's a surprise, because usually you have
a theme. Yeah, yeah. A theme and a text. And there's, you know, I love Dharma stuff, so I have piles of texts waiting for sashins on my table. And I'm like, well, quick, we'll never get through this pile. Let's bring one out. And I haven't, even several times, like, picked one up to bring it to the talk. And no, don't use this now. Yeah. They're often texts about the heart of the matter, but I'm like, it might distract me a little bit from the heart of the matter to try to like present this text. We did talk about Bankei a couple days. Bankei Zenji. Resting, you're unborn in the unborn. Everything is resolved in the unborn Buddha mind. And he was one who actually said, we have this sesshin here. In most places, they have all these, you know, scheduled periods and rituals and things like that. But here, we have this time set aside for zazen, but people can basically do whatever they want. So there is that style. So I would never say people can't do whatever they want. But we also offer this particular trellis. It's an offering, not a infliction. Take this trellis now. Sometimes it might feel like that, yeah. You're getting beaten over the head by the trellis of sesshin. It's just an offering to express, to celebrate Buddha flowers. Everything can express Buddha flowers. We just have this particular family style. It's nice to keep alive, just like traditional ballet dances. You know, people still keep the same old forms. There's modern dance too, stuff like that. But I think it's kind of sweet that, you know, traditional ballet from Europe in the several 1700s it began. So at that time it was this new innovation. And then, but there's something just beautiful about carrying on that form. So it's kind of, I feel like it's kind of like that here. We have this ancient trellis form that's so beautiful, even though it's maddening sometimes. And, if you have doubts, don't hesitate to speak them while there's the opportunity.
I was so glad you said it was maddening sometimes. That's how it was when I was driving home last night.
You're like, I'm coming back here to just get a little bit of sleep, just to come back and do it again.
Why am I in such pain? What am I doing? Oh yeah, please pass the trellis.
Pass the trellis, please. But there it is, right there. Why am I in such pain? Instead of like, how curious, there's a pain body driving a truck. But whose pain body and truck is it? And whose farm is it that this body and truck are going back to? And whose body truck is going to come back the next day? Very strange. Who set all this in motion? And who's going to stop it? And who's going to resist it? And who's going to drop it off? And what's going on here anyway? One thought arose during zazen on one of these days, one of those big thoughts, like, why, you know, my teacher says, don't ever ask why questions, but this one arose, and, you know, there, of course, there's no answer, but, like, the question was, they kind of, like, made my little bit of hair stand on end a little bit when I like dug into the question, but the question is like, why is there anything at all? Why is there anything? I mean, it's so, we just like take it for granted. There's a universe. You know, I kind of like, well, you look around at all this stuff, and you can say, oh, I see why, how this all evolved from humans and other creatures and intentions, and the planet Earth came from the sun, and you know, the sun with gases coming together, but why is there even space? I got back that far. Why is there a universe at all? Not to mention conscious life. Why is there anything? There could be nothing. And don't go there. But it's kind of an expansive question you could ask for fun during Zazen. Why is there anything? Another question you could ask is there anything? Is there really anything? But there definitely is appearance of a universe. Why? You can see this is how all religions begin. I think this is how all religions begin. Somebody starts asking that. And there's no answer, but it's fun to build religions around. Okay. Do some Kenyan, yeah. May any good vibes arisen in this apparent room today, equally extend throughout the apparent universe to every apparent being and place. So all may open to the heart of the matter. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.